every morning. Last time we were talking about the communication systems model, and this is what it takes to get some sort of message from sender to receiver. Across a wireless link, or across, I shouldn't say, this is just point to point, right? Okay. And so we know that our messenger's voice, it starts out as an analog signal which we have to digitize, and then we have a stream of data, so we want to process that. We might use a source of code to compress the number of bits that we're sending, so we reduce what we have to send for efficiency purposes. Once we've done that, we might actually add in some redundancy in order to deal with errors and loss in the channel. And so, through the source encoder and the channel encoder, we then need to translate that stream of bits into a radio frequency signal, which is some form of sinusoidal wave. And so there's a number of ways of doing that, and then that's transmitted over a radio link. Okay, so we left this with a radio link dead. At the other end, naturally, we just unwind everything we've done. So we translate the bits from the radio signal into bits. We interpret them, so we try and do things like error tests and we're going to decode our original encoding. And naturally, our goal is to get the information through correctly, as efficiently as possible. Okay, so there's a trade-off between how many bits you send and, sort of again, resistance to error. So, what we're going to look at today is last piece of the puzzle, the radio link, and we're just going to see what characteristics it has as distinct from a wired link. And again, the main source of the notes is William Stallings, and then again, Goldsmith and Black, the detailed discussions of some of these. Okay, so we're going to concentrate on this radio channel and all the characteristics of the radio channel. So the device through which our radio signal is going to be transmitted and received is an antenna. And then we're pretty much just going to assume that they exist and they have certain characteristics. We'll mention them briefly. What we're concerned with mainly is the signal traveling through this channel. And there's a lot of issues that we don't typically consider with wired links, most of which have to do with the power at the power of the received signal relative to the power of the transmitted signal. And this power is decreasing with distance. And we'll see that there's a number of contributing factors that make the way in which this power decreases fairly complicated. Adding to that is the idea of mobility. So we don't have a point-to-point link that we can precisely characterize, because at least one end of our link could additional complicating factors which we're going through. Okay. So an antenna is an electrical conductor or system of conductors used for transmission of radio frequencies and reception of radio frequencies. And the same antenna both receives and transmits. Now, pretty much the only thing that we're going to account for with antennas is that we'll be able to abstractly think of them as radiating in a sphere, or you can think of their radiation and hence reception as being directional, as being pointed, the power being pointed in a particular direction. Okay. So, antennas in general radiate in three dimensions. Frequently, you might see cross sections of that radiation, but most of the pictures I've shown in the three representations. Okay. And again, you can get a little bit of an ideal antenna mounts radiated in all directions, or the antenna has directionality. Which means that you have a maximum direction, there's an optimal direction, and then around that you have what's called beamwidth, which indicates sort of within that direction how spread out the radiation pattern is. And so the beamwidth is the angle within which the power is radiated by the antenna, so it's half of the preferred direction. So again, this angle is going to give you how concentrated the transmission is in a specific direction. We are going to sum that all up by a term called gain, which again is the power transmitted in any direction versus any direction. And again, in terms of reception, the antenna's reception is equivalent to the radiation pattern. So if you have a directional antenna, it's going to obviously pick up signals in one direction better than it would pick up signals in any other direction. So, our ideal case, this is an abstract concept, this was called an isotropic antenna. And so the isotropic antenna emits the signal equally in all directions at some fixed power level. And so that power density is measured at some radius d from the center of the So, in actuality, ideal isotropic antennas cannot necessarily be built, real antennas, for that reason, and because it's useful, tend to concentrate their power in a specific direction, and that's measured by, first of all, the conductivity, and that's measure of directivity is the maximum power density over the mean power density. Okay. And so, in general, if you want to build a directional antenna, you get something like this. So you have a major load, and again, you see that's focusing power in one direction. Typically, you can't completely do that, and you will have some power swing in other directions.
Okay. Now, the factor
that's most relevant to us in terms of directional antennas is what's called the gain. And the gain refers to the power output in a specific direction compared to the output of an omnidirectional isotropic antenna. This means that you're emitting the sort of power level, you're now focusing the power in a given direction. So again, for the same power, you get higher signals in a specific direction. The gain is going to be a function of the size and shape of the antenna, and this effect is captured in what's called the effective area of the antenna. And so there's a relationship between the gain and the effective area of the antenna. And then this relationship is variable with the wavelength and or the frequency at which you're transmitting.
Okay, so again,
the term gain for propagation, discussing propagation factors,
it's the main one that we concern ourselves with. And so,
what types of antennas are there? Well, we have omnidirectional. They're not perfectly spherical, but we'll see if we can get something approximating a sphere. Or sectorized, which will again radiate out in specific directions. Or indeed, you can get something that's one component, so
concentrates the signal in a fairly tight direction. Okay.
And so that's what you, those are the types of things you see on phone masts, for instance. Obviously, they're a bit big for mobile equipment, you get things like microstrip patches, coils of metal, essentially, within the device.
Okay.
So one common type of antenna is the dipole antenna. And it's built from wire that's half a wavelength long and does not radiate in the direction of the ends of the wire. Okay, so you're not getting, it's not quite an ideal, it won't give you quite an ideal isotropic antenna. In general, what it's going to do is it'll generate radiation patterns which are donut shaped for oil and how many depends on the frequency of emission. So again, if you do this, instead of essentially radiating from 60 degrees, you want to radiate outwards in plane, then you can get a gain over an isotropic antenna. Again, you can also use them to come closer to building actual isotropic antenna or something close to an isotropic. Okay, and how you do that depends on the frequencies at which you transmit, and again, your basic dipole you can transmit at the frequency that it was built at, and you get a single lobe. If you transmit then at multiple frequencies, you end up getting these multiple lobes. And again, you see that you get something that's closer to looking like
360,
but looking like an isotropic radius in all directions. Again, other antennas are used for a more directional transmission. So one typical way of getting directionality would be through a parabolic antenna. And here again, all of the radiation is focused in a specific outward direction. Okay, so you have this reflective curve and a focus, and if you transmit from the focus, again, it gets the transmission is being reflected out all in a parallel direction, and sort of incoming would be the opposite. Anything you're getting from that parallel direction will be reflected back. Okay, so again, the takeaway points are that the antenna is the device through which you send and receive signals, and depending on the shape and size of the antenna, you can concentrate those signals you can concentrate the signals into a specific direction. And there is a gain factor in that direction, which means for the same power output, you can have more power traveling in a single direction versus if it was traveling in the isotropic. Okay, so when the antenna transmits this signal, it then is traveling through the air, and again, what we're primarily concerned with is what happens to it as it travels, and short answer to that is that the power decreases with distance, from the transmitting antenna. Now there are three paths that a radio signal can take. The first, ground waves, follows the contour of the Earth. Low frequency signals, and an example of this would be an AM radio. The main advantage is that you can, the signals will travel a long way. Skywave bounces between the Earth's surface and the outer atmosphere. And so, again, you can travel a long way, also at low frequencies. And so these are radio applications, CB radios, and ham radios, international broadcasts that we are intending to send transmissions to distant countries. The one that we're concerned with is what's called line of sight transmission, and this works at higher frequencies. And as said, you have to have some path from sender to receiver, you know, the initial definition would be sort of an unobstructed path between sender and receiver. As it turns out, well, you can, in some cases, you'll be bouncing off other objects, bending around other objects. You don't actually have to have necessarily physical oversight, but you have to find a path over which the radio waves travel. So we're going to look at this line of sight propagation, and we're going to see that there are a number of factors that affect the line of sight propagation and affect the power at which the signals receive. First of these is free space loss, and that says just no matter what, you're out in the middle of space, your signal is going to decrease in strength. Since we're not out in space, other factors are going to have an impact as well, even just sending through the air, the emergency is going to bounce around and refract through the air, and so in the atmospheric absorption, in the further decreasing signal. And because, again, our path from sender to, or our line of sight from sender to receiver might have objects in the way, and we're going to bounce off those objects, possibly objects that can block the signal. You have multi-path effects, and so you start with, again, your original transmission. By the time it arrives at the receiver, it will be traveling along a number of different paths, and so you get a number of copies of the central signal all arriving at the receiver, and they are combined with slightly different characteristics because of the different path that they took in the combined difficult to predict ways. Okay. And again, on top of all of that, you have mobility, so it's not like you've got your senders fixed in one position, your receiver fixed in another. One or both of them could possibly be moving. And again, that will cause somewhat difficult to predict changes to the signal. Okay. So we're going to have a look at how these various factors impact our signal, and particularly on the digital signal, as opposed to just a random radio wave. And we're going to see that the models that you can use to represent this are relatively complex. Typically, it's difficult to come up with analytic models. A lot of times, people resort to models based on empirical data. So you actually go around the city and you observe signal strengths. So you go around building and you observe signal strengths. And you can generalize from what you observe. Okay. So, we use the term fading to refer to the reduction of the power of a transmitted signal, determined by the position of the receiver relative to the transmitter. These effects are related to the distance from the transmitter and also the interference experienced by the intervening terrain, and also, we missed out the mobility of the center of the receiver. Usually, we classify these effects into two categories. We have large scale fading effects or small scale fading effects. Large-scale fading effects are due to the large distance between the sender and the receiver. So if I'm making a mobile phone call, the receiver could be a mile away. And so again, my power is increasing based on that distance, and possibly also what the terrain is like between me. Small scale fading effects, the large scale fading, it's not going to change much if I walk from this end of the room to the other end of the room. So over short distances, it's not going to change much. Small scale fading effects are observed with small changes in the position of sender relative to receiver. So again, if I walk from the center room to the other end of the room, I could very well experience small scale fading effects. And we'll see that again, they're based on these small changes in position and also on motion. Okay, so just the fact that I'm moving will change the signal. Okay. Now, what impact do these effects have on the signal? Well, there's two possibilities. One is signal attenuation. And this just means, again, the amplitude of the signal decreases, the power in the signal decreases. Okay. And so what you need then is to transmit at sufficient power that at the receiving end you are able to overcome noise. Having said that, you want to make balance of not sort of either overpowering the receiver circuitry or taxing your signaling device as well. So you want to use enough power, but only just. if your signal covers a larger frequency bandwidth, then it's possible that certain portions of that band, of that frequency bandwidth, are affected in a different way than other portions. So the attenuation is not uniform over the whole bandwidth. And in this case, the changes to the signal will not be uniform, and you get distortion of the signal. Okay. This may or may not be a problem, depending on again, how easy it is to recover the bit in the presence of distortion. So if you have an analog signal, for instance, then it's difficult to recover from distortion. For bits, you may be able to. Okay, so we're going to go over the two forms of fading, so our large-scale fading and our small-scale fading. And again, we'll start with large-scale fading. It's a bit more straightforward. And the primary components of large-scale fading is free space loss. And so no matter what, again, your signal is going to attenuate. And the attenuation factor is related to the square of the distance between sender and receiver. Okay. Assuming we have gains in our transmitter and receiver, we have to account for the gains. And then, mission and the distance. And so, again, the main term that we're going to hang out to here is the change is with distance squared. Naturally, you can relate the gains to the fact of area. And so you just deal with one term or the other. So Amanda Steele. Receiver, and so you can see that's the power of the transmitter boosted by any gain factor and diminished by the distance squared. Okay. The loss is the ratio of the power of the receiver to the power of the transmitter, and again, the farther you go, the greater the distance, the greater the loss. And then if you want, you can put that all into decibels as well. Again, it's just, the nice thing about decibels is you isolate matters. You can isolate out the individual factors. Okay. In order to simplify the system. Frequently, we measure the power received relative to a standard reference point or standard reference distance. Okay. And so, in this case, the ratio of the power received to the power at the specific distance is just relative to V0 over E, of course, all squared. And so again, we see the factor count is that the power received is proportional to 1 over E squared. Now, additional to our pre-space laws, we get what is called shadowing. And shadowing is just the impact of the terrain on this specific signal. And so basically, again, as you send your signal, you may have a line of sight path to the receiver. But in addition to this, the transmitting signal is going to be reflecting off other objects. So it can reflect off buildings, reflect off the ground, reflect off a number of different objects. And every time it does that, you can think of it as a signal taking a different path to the destination. The signal can be bent around objects, so you sort of cut the corner, bending around the object. And the signal can also sort of diffuse through the less dense objects. Okay. What this means is that in addition to getting the signal received along the direct route, it's travels along any number of different routes to the receiver. And the main issue with that is that these different routes are all of different length, and therefore the signal is slightly changed and essentially the phase of the signal ends up being changed. And so when all of these signals combine at the receiver, you may get a greater or smaller amplitude for the signal. Okay. So this shadowing leads to what's called a multipath effect. Again, we're getting multiple copies of our signal being received. Okay. This can either reinforce or cancel out the original signal. Okay. So this has, again, a couple of different effects when you think about the transmission bits. So if you think about the transmission of single bits, again, you get this idea that either enhancing the signal or interfering with the signal. But additionally, depending on the path that they travel out, they travel on, if you're sending a train of bits, then you may have two separate bits being received from more than one different bits being received at the same time. Okay. So this effect of the signals traveling along different paths, which take different amounts of time to arrive, is referred to as time dispersion. And time dispersion causes what's called inter-symbol interference. Okay. And you can see what that is in our example. So we can think of our signal traveling along two separate paths. Okay. One is direct, and the other is it's bouncing off some distant galaxy. Okay. And if we think of a chain of signal or the chain of bits or a frame of bits being sent, then the N train once arrives directly at the receiver, and another one is taking a long time as it bounces off some distant object. What that means is that possibly at the time where along the direct path you received your first bit and you're now receiving your second bit, that's when the reflection of the first bit arrives at your receiver. And so you have the bits, the symbols interfering with each other. And again, the hope is that if this traveled a much longer path, then it's also, we hope, attenuated a lot of the received at the receiver. So, but it still does add to factor in reception. Beyond that, again, even within a single signal, you can have, if you have multiple paths, you can have the signals traveling along these different paths and combining, again, to get a slightly different version of the signal. Okay. Now, again, typically you're going to have a lot of different paths, and it becomes very difficult to predict exactly how the signal will be impacted. What we're going to do is look at the sender and the receiver out in the middle of a field somewhere, on a very flat plane somewhere. So you're going to get two copies of your signal. You're going to get your direct line of sight copy, and you're going to get a second copy bouncing off the ground and being received. Okay. And so we're going to look at, for this specific case, how the signals combine. So, we'll consider our normalized free space loss equation. So, we have our power at a specific distance and then the power at some distance d. And so the signals being transmitted are sinusoidal. And whether they can combine or interfere is going to be dependent on the phase shift relative to each other, so the difference in phase. So for a single signal, we can represent it in imaginary realm as a sort of sign becomes E beyond 2 pi f t
minus tau, so the difference in the time for the two signals.
And so that term can be pulled out, and we can generate
phi. So again, our phase shift. Okay.
And so our received power is going to be the sum of the power received along both paths. And so
it's going to be a function of
the distance traveled and the relative
phase of the two signals.
Okay. And so we take the difference between our two signals. Okay, and so what we need to do is figure out what this difference term amounts to, and so we need to look at what the distances d1 and d2, and then the phase
differences phi1 and phi2.
Okay. Now, the distance along the direct path is difference in the antenna heights, squared plus d squared, square root of all that, so there's a right angle triangle there. And the distance along the indirect path is going to be the sum of the two heights plus d squared squared. Okay. Now, if we assume that d is much bigger than our antenna heights, then both of those terms are close to d, so we can approximate both d1 and d2 as d. This leaves us with our phases, phi, and again, we can combine them now into a term delta phi. And delta phi is a function of our frequency and the difference of
the distance traveled. Okay.
In order to find the difference in the distance traveled delta d, we use a Taylor expansion on d1 and d2. And so we look at just the first two terms of that Taylor expansion. And when we take the difference, all of these disappear, and we're left with the difference between h1 minus h2 squared and h1 plus h2 squared, which is 2 h1 over h2. And then that's all. Okay, so anyway, we can get the term for delta phi solution, the difference in phase, and it's a function now of the antenna heights and
the overall distance between sender and receiver. So
we plug that delta phi term in now. And we observe that the E's of delta B is small. So we can approximate E to the J delta B by 1 minus J delta D. And when we plug that in, of course, we're left with this delta B term. So the 1 minus E J to delta B, and that's squared. We plug in our value for delta B in terms of H1, H2, and D. And we get now that we've added essentially an extra b squared term. Our power is now dropping with d to the 4. So we've changed from the power dropping in free space as d squared, now the power is dropping. Again, this is the result you would get in a fairly uncomplicated landscape. Again, it's going to be something like a plane with nothing on it besides your sender and receiver. Obviously, that's not what is out there. If you think about a city, you've got tall buildings, you have the terrain, might have hills or valleys or whatever, so you get a much more complicated picture than just this bouncing up once off the ground. Okay. So, one approach to dealing with this problem is to come up with empirical models for how loss occurs or within different types of terrain. Okay. So typically these models within things like buildings and rooms, there's a lot of work to actually grind out, how many paths do you have, and what the characteristics of those paths are. In general, sort of in outdoor areas, you have empirical models, which make extensive observations of a single setting and build a model based on those observations and then try to generalize from this setting to other settings. And so I'm going to show you three different models that take this approach. Being built up on empirical data. And the main thing I want you to appreciate coming out of this is just, what's the general approach of the models and how the models sort of differ from each other in their approach, and then sort of what the limitations of this sort of approach are. So we'll start with the Lee model, which is relatively simple, and it's based on data from Los Angeles in California. We'll look at the Akamura model, which is based on Tokyo data. And again, it's a more detailed model. And then we'll look at the Hatha model, which was an essential attempt to, in some ways, simplify the Akamura model. Again, we'll sort of observe just to start that they are all based on specific empirical data. And so they are, to some extent, applying them, you need to consider whether your situations in any way relates to the original scenarios on which she's based. But for instance, Tokyo, Tokyo's a bit like Dublin, but bigger. It's a very flat city. Okay. Los Angeles has pockets of high buildings here and there. So, and again, the characteristics of the terrain differ. You question how relevant something like, well, I believe Lee or Yakumura model would be to New York City, where it's all skyscrapers, for instance. So the applicability, you struggle a bit with applicability, realism. Okay. So again, the Lee model is based on Los Angeles data. And the measurements are taken at a specific frequency. Again, it was related to the cellular system at the time. And so what you get is that your power decreases with distance according to some factor gamma. And again, that factor gamma is then correlated to different scenarios. Okay. It also is relative to frequency. And again, according to some factor M, and M is again related to topography of your application. And then it inserts another correction factor, F0, okay, which is a function of things that are in M. So again, the first factors, P0 and gamma, are selected experimentally based on measurements. Okay, and so they've been done in sort of generic cases. And then for specific cities. So the F0 correction factor is a function of the antennas being used, so their heights and their gain factors. N is a function of the topography. And differs depending on whether you're in a suburban or an urban area. And so, again, the original data was measured according to a specific scenario, so fixed carrier frequency, antenna heights, gains, etc. Okay. So, again, the interesting thing about it is that it is an attempt to characterize quite a complex system according to relatively small number of inputs. Okay. Again, there's a number of these types of models. One of the most commonly used now is the Nakamura model, and it's a bit more detailed than the Lee model. It's possibly a bit more accurate. But again, it's initially based on measurements for the city of Tokyo, which has a very specific topological They consider now a larger range of frequencies, and you can extrapolate. So, they need a bunch of, actually measure everything at multiple frequencies and multiple antenna heights. And so, in place of the equations that Lee has, they have sets of curves which give attenuation relative to free space frequencies and infinites, et cetera. I mean, yeah, they use the sets of curves as the correction factors. Okay, so as before, you have determined free space loss, or sorry, not free space loss, your loss, and it's phrased slightly differently as the 50th percentile propagation loss, which means that that's the loss experienced by half of your signal. And it's obviously a function of free space loss, and then a number of these corrective factors. Okay, so the graph, the interplay between frequency and distance, use that as a corrective factor, and then they have a number of gain factors, which are related to antenna heights, and then again, just the type of terrain you might be using. Okay. So again, they correct free space loss relative to frequency and distance. And then they correct according to terrain. And again, that's relative to the frequency that you're using. And they also take antenna height into account. Okay. And again, in order to do this, they have measurements and they graph all these measurements. So, again, I'm not going to dwell on the example. Essentially, in order to find your path loss, you're going to have to take each of these factors into account and then again refer to the graphs. Okay, so you can calculate free space loss. You refer to the chart to find A at a specific frequency and distance. And then you again refer to the charts to find the different gain factors and decide what terrain you're in. Okay, so quite a detailed model, and again, at least for Tokyo, it was already predicted attenuation within Tokyo pretty well. And again, there's a lot of interesting how one can be mapped onto other systems and terrains. One drawback of this model is the fact that we keep referring back to these all of these different charts. So our last model that we're going to look at is the Hatha model, and essentially took the Akamura model and then tried to simplify the charts into a mathematical equation. In order to do that naturally, we're going to lose some axes. So, again, you get the same thing as function of frequency of antenna gains and antenna heights.
Okay. And so you have correction factors for all of these terms. The correction factors, again, depend on frequency and possibly terrain. So, again, you have, depending on terrain, you have slightly different equations. And so, again, it slightly simplifies the Akamura model. It's still complex, and there's still the issue of some relevance to any specific topology at this part. Okay, and people have worked on improving on these models over the years, I should say. Okay, so that's an example of what people do to try and figure out what exactly your reception strength is. Likely, if you're trying to site an antenna, for instance, what you'll be doing actually is taking measurements. Okay. Now, as we continue with the course, the takeaway factor of this is just that power loss is characterized by a drop off with some factor of the distance. Okay. And we'll assume that this the factor of power is between 2 and 5.5. Next week, when we look at sort of cellular systems, we'll see what abstract or think about how you lay out cellular systems. Okay. So that's large scale fading, and moving forward, that's pretty much what we're going to concern ourselves with. Again, there are because of the mobility of the sender and our receiver, you also get effects that are noticeable with small changes of the distance between sender and receiver. Again, if you're thinking about the mobile system, just walking, you observe change, possibly sort of significant changes in the characteristics of the channel. So I'm going to take the break now, and when we return, we'll talk about the small scale.